Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram, published Saturday, October 23rd, 2021. Front page. Analyst says slow rig climb good for region. Cargyle says count is expected to be in the mid-80s range for the rest of the year. By Mella McEwen. A continued rise in demand for crude in the face of natural gas and coal shortages is giving oil markets their best performance in over 6 years. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange rose 4 of 5 trading days this week, capping the week with a $1.26 or 1.5% increase, closing at $83.76 a barrel, a level not seen since 2014. According to Bloomberg, this is the 9th consecutive weekly rise for crude prices and the longest stretch since 2015. The posted price ended the week at $80.24, according to Plains All American. Natural gas on the NYMEX also recovered from Monday's 42-cent slide that pushed prices below $5 per MCF for the 1 day. Prices added 16.5 cents Friday to close at $5.28 per MCF. OPEC continues to hold the line on production, and that makes the easiest path forward for crude higher. Mickey Cargyle of Cargyle Investment Management told the Reporter Telegram by email. We expect mid-80s to be the range for the remainder of the year. A cold winter will drive prices higher, and a warm winter will soften prices a bit. He noted that some analysts are calling for $100 oil by year-end. Cargyle went on to predict the Permian Basin rig count will continue its slow climb, which is good for the local economy. Turning to natural gas prices, which reached levels not seen in 13 years before moving lower, Cargyle said supply restrictions are driving prices higher. The shutdown in drilling activity during the COVID months of 2020 restricted production of natural gas. It is in short supply in the Eastern Hemisphere and driving all prices higher, he explained. Again, the severity of winter will determine demand and prices. Bloomberg attributed the stretch of price advances to members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and allied nations only modestly supplying the market, while U.S. crude supplies shrink. Bloomberg reported that President Joe Biden said Thursday night that Americans should expect high gasoline prices to continue into next year because of supply being withheld by OPEC and other foreign oil producers. Stockpiles at the biggest U.S. storage hub are draining to levels last seen when crude prices were at $100. While headline prices have been volatile over the past two sessions, the structural tightness in supply has been the biggest driver in the markets, John Kiduff, a partner at Again Capital LLC, told Bloomberg. There's no real sense in the market that OPEC Plus is going to be coming forward with any meaningful amount of additional crude oil in the near future. What I see is a market correctly pricing very tight conditions and conditions that will get tighter. David Martin, head of commodity desk strategy at BNP Paribas, told Bloomberg. We're going to draw stocks this quarter and next. Local jobless rate falls to 4.9%. Numbers are half of what TWC reported for last September. By Mella McEwen. Midland's labor market continues to rebound from the job losses caused by both the COVID-19 pandemic and associated oil market crash. The Texas Workforce Commission said Friday the unemployment rate in its Midland Metropolitan Statistical Area, MSA, which includes Midland and Martin counties, fell to 4.9% in September from 5.3% in August. The rate is also almost half the 9.8% reported last September. People continue to go to work, observed Willie Taylor, chief executive officer of the Commission's Workforce Solutions Permian Basin. Speaking with the Reporter Telegram by telephone, Taylor estimated 50,000 residents in the 17-county area he oversees have returned to work since the pandemic first hit in the spring of 2020. He added the number of residents receiving unemployment has fallen from a high of 72,000 to working with between 15,000 and 18,000 still receiving unemployment benefits. The labor market remains very tight, Taylor said. Everyone is feeling the shortage of workers, from truck drivers to medical technicians, HVA technicians, information technology, to linemen and educators, he said. Would-be employers may need to interview 20 to 30 people to get one new hire, he added. It's going to take some time to close that gap, he said. Residents should take advantage of the training opportunities, short-term and long-term, to find a job or upgrade their skills to advance in their work, he said. And for those who need child care assistance while they get training or work, he said his center has millions in funding available. He urged local chambers and other associations to do an even better job marketing the area to young people in an effort to keep them in the Permian Basin. It's amazing the drop-off in unemployment we've had in a year's time, he said. Midland's civilian labor force rose above 100,000 for the first time in over a year, coming in at 100,032 in September. That's about 2,500 more than the 97,547 reported a year ago. Of those in the labor force, just over 95,000 were employed, a gain of 7,100 over the year, and 4,950 were unemployed, a drop of 4,650 in a year's time. Midland added 1,200 jobs from August to September for a total non-farm job count of 98,600. Midland's dominant industry sector, mining, logging, and construction, led with the addition of 600 jobs. The leisure and hospitality and government sectors followed with 300 new jobs each, and the trade, transportation, and utilities sector added 100 jobs. The other services sector was the only one to post a loss, declining 100 jobs month to month. For the 12 months from September 2020 to September 2021, Midland has added 7,100 jobs for a growth rate of 7.8%. Mining, logging, and construction led with 3,100 new jobs, followed by the leisure and hospitality sector with 2,100 new jobs. Trade, transportation, and utilities added 1,100 jobs, and the financial activities sector, 400 new jobs. The government sector added 300 jobs, and the manufacturing sector, 200, followed by other services with 100 new jobs. The only sector to post a loss was education and health services, which has lost 200 jobs in the last 12 months. Statewide, the unemployment rate fell to 5.6% from 5.9% in August. The state added 95,800 jobs from August to September and has added 711,500 jobs since September 2020. Amarillo reported the lowest unemployment in the state at 3.4%, followed by Austin Round Rock at 3.5%, and Abilene, College Station Bryan, and Lubbock at 3.9% each. Beaumont, Port Arthur, and McAllen Edinburgh Mission had the highest unemployment at 8% each. MISD completes first week of intercession. Time set aside during fall break aims to give students additional learning opportunities, by Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD completed its first intercession week. An average of 4,501 students were on campuses across the city taking in extra help from nearly 500 total teaching staff, according to the district. There are two intercession weeks that are part of the 2021-22 calendar to provide the district an opportunity to reach students that it believes need extra help based on performance on tests or inside the classroom. The weeks give those students extra attention on a subject like reading or math. It also provides other enrichment opportunities. Heading into the intercession week, Midland ISD promoted Go for Launch, a space-themed science program for 8th through 12th graders, and a Princeton Review SAT-PSAT prep for high school students, made possible by Diamondback Energy. Midland ISD statistics show 5,033 students attended intersession on Tuesday, the highest one-day attendance total of the week. On Wednesday and Thursday, when there were not enrichment opportunities, the student population count dropped to 4,358 and 3,823 students, respectively. Midland ISD Associate Superintendent Charlie Garcia said one reason intercession is expected to produce results is the smaller student-to-teacher ratio that intercession affords. In some cases, Garcia said, the ratio was 12 to 1, which was an expectation when intercession was first pitched to Midland ISD School Board by former interim superintendent Ann Dixon. Garcia was pleased at the number of teachers that committed to intercession and what that says about their support of the district students. Whenever you have teachers that would rather work with children who are struggling than go and take an extra week of vacation, we always think that it's really a feather in our cap, Garcia said. Garcia said that a first opportunity to help Midland ISD officials judge how successful the fall intercession week was academically will happen after middle-of-the-year assessments. Those results will help educational leaders see the success for a student and for the entire district, and whether intercession is needed for a student, and what changes the district will need to make for the spring intercession, which will take place after spring break. That middle-of-the-year testing might also factor in the reports about intercession provided to the school board in January and February when board members begin to talk about the 2022-23 school year calendar. Administrators told the board this past year that an intercession calendar would help a district that has struggled academically for years and was impacted by learning loss during the COVID pandemic. Garcia said ultimately, the school board will hear from district committees, including the District Education Improvement Committee, when scheduling is talked about. But Garcia also expects real results when close to 5,000 students get 32 extra hours provided by 452 teachers and 26 literacy strategists that the district reported during the intercession week. Garcia acknowledged the fatigue that has set in with MISD students and teachers and said steps were taken to put the fun into the instructional week. It was not uncommon to have a change of environment, including one classroom that turned into an intercession week campground. We understand that they can be on vacation at home, and a lot of our kids would rather be on the PlayStation or on their phones or TikTok, Garcia said. We made a point to influence our principals, to influence our teachers, to create that fun environment for that reason. We want these kids to come back if we ask them to come back. Garcia added that research does not support that if you just sit for 8 hours over 4 days, it's going to get the results. Ex-employee sues store in case related to shooting, by Caitlin Randall. A former assistant manager at an Odessa Office Depot store has filed a lawsuit alleging she was fired after voicing concerns about the company's actions during the 2019 mass shooting that left 7 dead and 24 injured. Sarah Lubano filed the civil suit against Office Depot with the Ector County District Clerk's Office on September 27th. According to court records. The law firm representing Lubano, Houston-based NLC Law Group, published a press release Thursday stating the suit is connected to the 2019 Labor Day weekend shooting when a gunman drove through Odessa on an hour-long rampage. According to the press release, a supervisor called Lubano after the shooting began and told her to go outside the store to find out what was happening. The supervisor also allegedly gave Lubano conflicting instructions on whether to lock the store's doors, despite directions from police to keep the doors locked. Lubano spoke with Human Resources several times over the month after the shooting to express concern about the supervisor's actions, the release states. Shortly after Lubano's complaints, her supervisor began communicating with HR about terminating her position, according to the release. After taking medical leave, Lubano was fired over text message in January 2021, the release states. A spokesperson for Office Depot did not immediately respond to a request for comment. New trial set in suit against local eatery, by Caitlin Randall. A judge has ordered a new trial in the case of the Andrews man, who was awarded $5.5 million for a lawsuit against La Fogata Mexican Grill that alleged he sustained a head injury because a bartender had overserved him alcohol. Daniel Rawls filed a lawsuit through his attorney in May regarding an incident that occurred 2 years earlier. He claimed that he was injured during an altercation with another customer in the parking lot of La Fogata after both men were overserved, according to the lawsuit. Rawls was awarded $5.5 million on July 27th in a default judgment, meaning the owner of La Fogata did not respond to the suit or attend the hearing. The court did not rule on whether Rawls's claims were true. In a motion for a new trial, a judge overturned that default judgment and set a new hearing for 1:30 p.m. Monday. An attorney for Lourdes Galindo, the owner for La Fogata, stated in court filings that Galindo was not properly served the lawsuit and was not aware of the first hearing. Galindo states in an affidavit supporting a new trial that she forwarded the legal documents she received to her insurance company and thought the company would handle the case. She also states that she did not receive a notice to attend the July 27th hearing. Galindo, who cannot read in English and is legally blind, says in the affidavit that she did not understand the contents of the lawsuit. An additional sworn statement from a waitress at La Fogata, who was working the night of the incident, claims Rawls did not appear intoxicated. The waitress states that she observed Rawls drink a few beers with his meal, but did not think he was intoxicated. Later, the waitress was alerted by another person that a man was on the ground outside the restaurant, according to the statement. When the waitress started to call 911, she says a friend of Rawls offered to take him home, and he left in the friend's car. Rawls sued Galindo and La Fogata for five claims, including premises liability, negligence, and damages arising from foreseeable criminal conduct. Besides alleging he was overserved, Rawls also claimed Galindo failed to ensure the parking lot did not include obstacles that would pose a tripping or falling hazard to intoxicated patrons. Rawls allegedly has a history of excessive drinking. Andrews' jail records show he was arrested twice on charges of public intoxication, as well as in August of this year for driving while intoxicated. Sheriff states man suspected in three murders now in custody. The man wanted in the shooting death of three Midlanders was taken into custody by the Hereford Police Department without incident on Thursday. The Midland County Sheriff's Office reported early Friday morning that 23-year-old Kevin Martinez is currently in the Smith County Jail. Three warrants had been issued for Martinez for capital murder, according to a previous Sheriff's Office report. That report also stated that at approximately 2 a.m. Sunday, deputies with the Midland County Sheriff's Office responded to a call for a disturbance in the 1200 block of East County Road 124. Upon arrival, MCSO deputies located three victims with gunshot wounds. They were identified as 23-year-old James Davidson, 29-year-old Walter Ayala, and 35-year-old Gilberto Tapia Lopez. All three victims were pronounced deceased at the scene. Martinez fled the scene prior to the arrival of MCSO, according to the sheriff's office. This is an ongoing criminal investigation, and no further details are available. Rig Riders lead effort to feed first responders. Rig Riders Motorcycle Club partnered with local companies and organizations, including Oilfield Helping Hands, to host a cookout in appreciation of first responders Thursday outside Midland Memorial Hospital. Katie Grimes, president of the board at Oilfield Helping Hands Permian Basin Chapter, said the event was to say thank you for those working at MMH. She said the Rig Riders worked to have HEB donate enough food for around 1,200. We got everything paid for and got a bunch of companies out to cook and say thank you, Grimes said. Oilfield Helping Hands, Grimes said, takes donations, directs it elsewhere, and uses its platform to shed light on things taking place in the Permian Basin that could use love and attention. Today, we gave back to non-oilfield workers, Grimes said. Obituaries from the Midland Reporter-Telegram published Saturday, October 25th. Jose Reyes. Jose Reyes was born in Midland on July 29th, 1945, and peacefully passed away on Wednesday, October 20th, surrounded by his family. A viewing will be held on Tuesday, October 26th from 9 a.m. with a rosary to be recited at 7 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Funeral Mass is set for Wednesday, October 27th at 10 a.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Fairview Cemetery. He is survived by his girlfriend, Patsy Walker, his two sons, Joey Reyes and wife, Delma, Mark Reyes and his daughter, Nancy Zuniga, and husband, Frank, two sisters, Belma Espino and husband, Fernando, Josie Reyes, and one brother, Rudy Reyes, and wife, Aurora, nine grandchildren, seven great-grandchildren, and numerous nieces, nephews, and cousins. The family would like to thank everyone for their prayers and support, especially to the doctors and nurses at Midland Memorial Hospital. Funeral services are under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at LlewellynGarciaPipkinFH.com. Lydia Mendoza Cardoza. Lydia Mendoza Cardoza, age 85, passed away peacefully on October 19th at her home, surrounded by her family. She was born in Iguala, Guerrero, Mexico, on May 30th, 1936, to Juanita Sanchez Mendez and Jose Mendoza Luna. She married her husband, Jesse C. Cardoza, on September 16th, 1970. They were married for a strong 36 years. Lydia is survived by her brother, Dario Mendoza Sanchez, and sister, Celerina Mendoza Sanchez. Her three children, Rosalina Torres and Arturo Torres, Lydia Cardoza, Jesus Gaspar Cardoza, grandchildren Marcus R. Cardoza, Leo Paul Torres, Felix R. Cardoza, Marina Rose Silva, and Uriah Caden Cardoza, and her great-grandchildren. She is preceded in death by her husband, Jesse C. Cardoza, in 2006, her brothers Moises Sanchez, Miranda, and Baltazar Mendoza Sanchez. Church service will be at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine at 1401 Garden Lane, Midland, Friday, October 22nd at 2 p.m., reception to follow afterwards. The family of Cardoza wishes to thank Angels Care Hospice for all their support. Arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Oscar Ubansko. Oscar went to be with his Heavenly Father Monday, October 11th in San Angelo. He was born February 14th, 1952, to Bernard and Henrietta Ubansky. He was preceded in death by his father Bernard, mother Henrietta, sister Betty, two brothers Wayne and Ray, daughter Lisa, great-nephew Antonio. He is survived by his wife Kitty of San Angelo, daughter Becky McClure, and husband David of Midland, six grandchildren, 16 great-grandchildren. Oscar and Kitty loved their fur babies. They had numerous over the years. In lieu of flowers, please make a donation in Oscar's name to Purrs and Puppy Breath in San Angelo, Texas. Tamara Leah Maxson Wilson. Tamara Leah Maxson Wilson was born December 20th, 1962, to Rodney and Millie Maxson in Fort Smith, Arkansas. There was a celebration of life visitation with the family Sunday, October 17th, at the offices of Berger Haggard, 2501 Ridgemar Plaza, Fort Worth. There will be a formal funeral Monday, October 25th, at 11 a.m. at Holy Cross Lutheran Church, 5110 North Garfield, Midland. Burial will be private at a later date in Midland. Though Tammy had tons of charities that were near and dear to her heart, the family has chosen Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Midland for any memorials. Tammy is survived by her precious grandchildren, Trenton Wilson, Braden McGraw, and Leah McGraw. Also surviving are her children, Lindsay and James McGraw of Arlington, Brian Wilson of Forney, and Brittany Wilson of Arlington. Her parents, Rodney and Millie Maxson of Midland, her siblings, Debbie Lawrence of Midland, Kent and wife Cindy Maxson of Nashville, and Joan and husband Steve Mayo of Denison, along with beloved nieces who loved their shenanigans with Aunt Tammy. Death notices. Angela Wrinkle. Angela Wrinkle, 57, of Marble Falls, passed away October 18th. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday, October 29th, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, October 30th at Nally Pickle and Welch Chapel, with interment following at Rest Haven North Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at npwelch.com. Linnell Sawyer. Linnell Sawyer, 68, of Stanton, passed away October 21st. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Monday, October 25th at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home in Midland. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Tuesday, October 26th at Hosanna Christian Fellowship in Stanton, with interment following at Evergreen Cemetery. Survivors include husband Clarence. Arrangements under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at npwelch.com. Walter Guillermo Ayala. Walter Guillermo Ayala, 35, of Midland, passed away Sunday, October 17th. Viewing will be Monday, October 25th from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., with the rosary to be recited at 7 p.m. Monday evening at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Funeral Mass will be Tuesday, October 26th at 10 a.m. at St. Stephen's Catholic Church. Burial will follow at American Heritage, 4100 FM 1788, Midland. He is survived by his wife, Yesenia Villalobos, his children, Walter, Zaid, William, Waylon, and Sophia Ayala, his parents, Ramon and Clara Ayala, and his brother, Ramon A. Ayala.
Hello, this is Cindy reading from the Odessa American for Saturday, October 23rd. Bartlett issued trespass warning at MCH by Laura Dennis. Dr. Richard Bartlett was issued a criminal trespass warning from Ector County Hospital District Police after he was caught on a video first putting his hands in the trash and later in a patient area looking for plastic bags without a mask or gloves on. Bartlett does not have medical privileges at Medical Center Hospital and cannot be in the dock area or restricted patient areas or storerooms. The criminal trespass was issued Tuesday and means that Bartlett is not allowed in any MCH building unless he is actually a patient. If he violates the no trespass, he can be arrested. MCH CEO Russell Tippin said the matter was handled with a criminal trespass to protect our staff and the integrity of our hospital. Someone claiming to be a doctor and digging through your trash is not something you see every day. Bartlett was confronted by a respiratory employee who recognized him and asked him what he was doing in the restricted area of the hospital. Bartlett then snapped a photo of an equipment bag and turned and left. The incident was reported to the ECHD police, and a criminal trespass was issued to Bartlett through his attorney. MCH, like most hospitals during the COVID crisis, requires visitors to go through the front door for a health screening and to wear masks in the hospital. Bartlett, via phone on Friday, said he didn't see any no trespassing signs and simply went into the hospital after being invited in by the hospital worker. "It never crossed my mind a doctor couldn't go into a hospital," he said, but didn't indicate why he went through the back instead of the front. When asked if he was blaming the worker for his unauthorized entry, he said he never thought of going in until he was invited in, and added that the worker offered to let him speak to someone in the respiratory department. The dock area is in the back of the hospital, which requires an MCH badge for entry. Bartlett said he hasn't had privileges at MCH in a number of years and doesn't want them, but would not respond when asked what hospitals he does have privileges at. He told the worker he needed to find where we keep our COVID bags, Tippin said. Our employee thought he was being helpful to a doctor who needed help. Bartlett on Friday said he only went into the hospital because he was invited, but later said he had heard a lot about putting bags on patients' heads when questioned about what bags he was looking for. A social media post showing a photo of a young woman at MCH with a bag on her head who is being treated for COVID went viral, and MCH staff members have been bombarded with threats and claims of poor health care at the hospital and substandard care of patients. One of the written reports from a staff member who encountered Bartlett detailed that Bartlett told the staff member that he was looking for the COVID bags. The records and videos were obtained by the Odessa American through a public information request. Numerous videos from the hospital show Bartlett unmasked, walking through the area with the staff member. The officer notes on the criminal trespass report indicated that Bartlett used deception to enter through the dock area, unmasked, unscreened, and no ID as required. Dr. Bartlett then went to the respiratory unit, taking pictures of the equipment that was covered with clear coverings located on 2 West. The bag controversy was addressed during a Monday Zoom news conference when Tippin said MCH's Exposure Committee and Transportation Committee met about how to transport patients around the hospital. Tippin on Monday said he had spoken with the mother of the girl in the photo and apologized. "We at Medical Center realized that we had a situation that we failed to do our best and that we failed to give them the best experience possible. We do apologize for that." On Friday, Tippin said complaints are taken seriously. "We look at what did we do right and what we can do better. This situation has given us an opportunity to figure out how we can get better." This week, the Department of State and Health Services, on behalf of the Centers for Medicare Services, investigated a complaint based on the photo, Tippin said. On Friday, Tippin said a report from the DSHS should be issued in about 10 days. Bartlett has been at odds with health officials over what Bartlett has called his silver bullet treatment to cure COVID. Local health officials, as well as many national officials, say there is no silver bullet or single treatment that can cure COVID. Bartlett each week is on local radio stations touting his treatment and also warning patients from vaccines, which local health officials have strongly supported. On a Friday morning radio show, Bartlett indicated he has little faith in vaccines, including the influenza vaccine, which he said only has about a 40% effectiveness rate. Tippin said he has never been involved in a situation like someone sneaking into a hospital. "We are educating our staff to make sure they are guarded, and this is an eye-opener. Not everyone wants to do good by the hospital. The hospital is doing the best as we know how to do it, and it is a new struggle every time we turn around." LIP combines strategies to help victims by Royal McGregor. Crisis Center of West Texas wanted to implement a program that combined its efforts with local law enforcement. After researching and seeing what has worked in other parts of the country, the Crisis Center of West Texas has decided to use the Lethality Assessment Protocol, LAP. That program began in Ector County in March 2020 and for the last year and a half, the Crisis Center of West Texas has received about 8 LAP referrals per week. Crisis Center of West Texas Director of Client Services, Gabriella Sperger, said, "We had already seen that it was a tool that was used around the nation and in other communities, and we saw that it was successful," Sperger said. "We wanted to do the same. We worked with law enforcement, and we collaborated as a team, and then we got it implemented in March of 2020. LAP is a strategy aimed at preventing domestic violence homicides. In a 7-month span from 2020 and 2021, family violence crimes recorded by the city of Odessa have risen by a little more than 10%. The family violence crime numbers from January 2020 to July 2020 were 928, while those numbers have increased to 1,024 from January 2021 to July 2021, according to the National Incident-Based Reporting System report provided by the Odessa Police Department. When you look at our domestic violence numbers here in the city of Odessa and in Ector County, they aren't good at all," OPD Chief Michael Gerke said. "We are looking for any type of way to bring those numbers down." Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths said his department relished the opportunity to join efforts with the Crisis Center of West Texas. "Family violence isn't our business, but for the Crisis Center of West Texas, that's their main business, and when they brought this to our attention, we were on board immediately," Griffiths said. "We welcomed that program, and we got on board. We are proud to be part of that." During an interview with Sperger, she walked through the steps of procedures of LAP. Sperger said the first step is when law enforcement is called out to a scene, and they go through their investigation process. If law enforcement figures out it's a domestic violence situation, they will complete an LAP assessment one-on-one with the survivor, and then law enforcement will make a phone call to the Crisis Center of West Texas. Gerke detailed the LAP assessment has different weighted points, and once a certain level is reached, then officers automatically call the Crisis Center of West Texas. "We've always mentioned there are places out there like the Crisis Center or Safe Place that they can receive services, but this takes that out of equation because we will give the phone over to the victim," Gerke said. "We are there for security." Victims of domestic violence are given the choice whether they want to enter the shelter at the Crisis Center of West Texas or not. If a person decides they want to enter the shelter, Sperger said those victims are typically transported to that facility by law enforcement. "Regardless if a person enters the shelter, everyone in LAP can receive counseling and legal services." Sperger said recently it's more common for people to only request counseling and legal services. "The choice of receiving additional help and services from the Crisis Center of West Texas is ultimately up to the victim of domestic violence. It all depends on the survivor, what choice they make," Sperger said. "Sometimes they decide to accept services and continue. Sometimes they aren't ready and they don't. It's a case-by-case basis." Years in the making. UTPB hosts grand opening for Performance Center, by Ruth Campbell. After waiting about a year due to COVID, the University of Texas Permian Basin finally had the ribbon cutting and grand opening for the D. Kirk Edwards Family Human Performance Center Friday. The event, held in the midst of homecoming festivities, was attended by about 200 people. Before the ceremony, UTPB President Sandra Woodley told the media that the building has been in service for about a year, but Friday was the day they were able to celebrate. Woodley said it's a beautiful 63,717-square-foot state-of-the-art facility dedicated to athletics and academics. She noted that all the community leaders were in attendance who dedicated time, money, and energy to the facility. "We couldn't be more thrilled," Woodley said. She noted that the building contains kinesiology, athletic programs, and research. It also offers labs and research opportunities for faculty and students. Woodley said Edwards is a pillar in the community and a leader in many ways. He contributed time, money, and energy to get our football program started, and he also invested in this facility. So we're really thrilled to honor Kirk Edwards and his family today for their investment in this facility, Woodley said. Chief of Staff Tatum Hubbard was the MC. The national anthem was sung by music education major Mayra Gutierrez. UT System Chancellor James B. Milliken offered congratulations. Student athletes Marquez Bird and Lauren Stallworth spoke, as did Director of Athletics Todd Dooley. Tim Edgman, Chairman of the Odessa Development Corporation, and Edwards himself. Woodley said during the ceremony that they were celebrating what the building signifies for UTPB and what it can help them accomplish for the region. This wonderful facility, it houses the next generation of healthcare professionals, social workers, community health leaders, scientists, thought leaders. It is also home to our student athletes, Woodley said. Woodley said the students are the reason for the facility, but she also wanted to thank Representative Tom Craddock, Republican Midland, former Speaker of the Texas House, Senate Senator Cal Seliger, Republican Amarillo, and Republican Brooks Landgraf, Republican Odessa, for their leadership and advocacy. We're also thankful for the support that we have received from the UT system, Woodley said. Woodley also thanked retired athletic director Scott Farmer and president CEO of Odessa Regional Medical Center, Stacy Brown, and many other philanthropists. Woodley also expressed thanks to Gail Dodson for letting them name the athletic training room for the late Doc Dodson, a legendary Midland High School athletic trainer. Woodley praised the 92% pass rate for its nursing programs, overseen by Donna Buke, Dean of the College of Health Sciences and Human Performance. Milliken said Edwards has been a stalwart at the UT system and a huge support of UTPB and his alma mater, UT Austin. He's also been a member of the Chancellor's Council Executive Committee, which is a select group of Texans who, because of their generosity and their commitment, spend time advising me and supporting the entire UT system. He's also served on the University Lands Advisory Board, which is just an incredibly important position to help treasure, preserve, nurture that great asset that the University of Texas system has, the 1 million-plus acres in the Permian Basin. And so he has contributed in so many ways. This newest addition, which will add so much, I think, to the health and the welfare and the fitness of this campus community and the larger community, Milliken said. He added that he's looking forward to hearing more about the research and teaching that will happen at the center as well. Buke said the building is not only gorgeous but is highly functional for educating and training human performance and healthcare professionals. Most likely you've heard on news reports across America about the nursing shortage, the alarming fact that America will need at least 200,000 new nurses per year to meet the increased demand. However, the outlook is actually even more critical than that, as there are shortages of human performance and healthcare workers as a whole. It's not just nurses. Especially in the vulnerable rural and urban areas, overall demand is projected to grow 16% by 2030, creating approximately 2.6 million new jobs that need to be filled, Buke said. There are several reasons that these areas have a higher demand than any other occupational group. It's primarily due to an aging population, and those who serve in these capacities are retiring themselves. Additionally, the impact of the pandemic. 30% of employees in these occupations have decided to leave their professions. So what are we going to do about this? UT Permian Basin is prepared to dramatically increase the number of its graduates and human performance and health sciences programs to help meet the local and regional needs, she said. In 2020, the decision was made to dissolve the College of Nursing and create the College of Health Sciences and Human Performance. We're growing student enrollment in our existing programs of athletic training, kinesiology, nursing, and social work. but more importantly, we are strategically adding programs and educational service lines that will help to meet the priority needs of our region, Buick said. Bird, a football player with a bachelor's degree in kinesiology and a master's in business administration, who is also going for another bachelor's degree, said when he first came to Odessa, the center was just a pile of dirt. They lifted weights in the gym above the basketball court, and now they have this amazing facility, Bird said. The building also offers quiet spaces to study and decompress. Stallworth, who plays basketball, is a double major in mechanical engineering and management. Her major means she doesn't take classes at the center, but she spends a lot of time there. When I was being recruited here, like Bird said, there was nothing here but a picture in the gym of what it could be. Just to see that vision come to life was a blessing in itself. The weight room has given my team, along with other teams that are larger, such as football and swimming and diving, the space to get their work done, along with providing us with the most state-of-the-art equipment. We have the newest dumbbells, the newest like anything you can think of. So that in itself has really prolonged or has helped us grow, Stallworth said. The first 2 years she was at UTPB, Stallworth said she stayed healthy, but this last year she is bouncing back from injuries, so she has used the underwater treadmill and cold tubs. A lot of people do not have that. I've talked to my other friends that are student athletes, have not had that, so it's just been amazing, she added. Edwards thanked former President David Watts, who finally gave in and started a football team. He said the facility started off at $2 million and was supposed to be a place kind of like at Permian High School, where the football team lifted weights, changed clothes, and things like that. But thanks to local lawmakers who got tuition revenue bonds, the building morphed into what it is today. The Odessa Development Corporation and Grow Odessa also contributed, along with many others. I just want to say again how much athletics changed my life, and I think it can change a person's life for the better. We've seen what football has done in Lubbock. We've seen what it's done in Waco for Baylor and things like that. And again, my vision for this town and this college is long after oil is gone. This campus, this university, our nursing schools, kinesiology, it will be why kids come to Odessa. It will transform why people live here. Because this campus, again, A&M is full, Texas is full, these kids have to go somewhere. Why not come to UT Permian Basin and help grow this community? I'm tremendously proud of what we've accomplished with this building, and I look forward to all of y'all seeing it that haven't been able to step inside because it is a phenomenal facility, Edwards said. Quick hits. The University of Texas Permian Basin Music Department will present a Symphonic Winds Halloween concert with conductor Gene Gomez at 6 p.m. October 31st at Wagner Knoll Performing Arts Center, 1310 North Farm to Market 1788, Midland. Costumes are encouraged. For more information, call 432-552-3286. Mary Marketplace. Tickets are now on sale for the Junior League of Odessa's 38th annual Mary Marketplace, Merry and Bright, taking place November 4th through the 7th at the Ector County Coliseum. The four-day extravaganza will feature holiday shopping from 80 hand-selected vendors from Texas and beyond, plus can't-miss special events, including the premier shopping party, ladies' champagne brunch, and breakfast with Santa. All proceeds support the Junior League of Odessa's mission to raise funds and provide volunteers for our local West Texas community. Tickets and sponsor tables are available for purchase. Tickets are non-refundable. For tickets, sponsor table, or more information, visit boxofficesolutions.net or call 800-514-3849. Local News Roundup. Launch Party Concert. Planmasters GPS LLC has scheduled WTX Manifest Music and Culture Launch Party Concert from 7 p.m. to midnight, November 12th at Dos Amigos, 4700 North Golder Avenue. Headlining will be CMT Music Award and ACM Award winner Jack Ingram and Latin Grammy Award nominees La Energia Norteña. Remy Riley will also be featured. For tickets or information, visit tinyurl.com/4C3AMZ3D. Fundraiser production. Basin Theater Works at the Permian Playhouse has scheduled the upcoming fundraiser production All Together Now, November 12th through the 13th at the Playhouse, 310 West 42nd Street. The musical review features a selection of songs from Broadway shows including Annie, Rent, Les Miserables, Hairspray, Waitress, and many more. The cast includes local singers and actors Scott Windham, Dawn Weeks, Sarah Lillestahl, Tyler Lillestahl, Heidi Jeffrey Taylor, Nikki Windham, Raislyn Miller, Davis Clark, Lily Windham, Annie Windham, Hope Joyce, Albert Hall, Oscar Coral, Stephanie Rivas Guerrero, Sam Weeks, Parker Leroy, Sarai Flores, and Michaela Grenier. For showtimes, tickets, or information, call 432-362-2329 or visit basintheaterworks.com. Local News Roundup. Women charged with assaulting each other over game room winnings. A 47-year-old woman and a 41-year-old woman were each arrested after they reportedly assaulted each other with a knife, after one woman accused the other of stealing money she made overnight at a game room. Kenyatta Johnson, 47, and Shaniqua Clay, 41, were each charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a second-degree felony, and public intoxication, a Class C misdemeanor. Johnson was additionally charged with possession of marijuana, a Class B misdemeanor. The reported assault happened at 7:20 a.m. October 20th in the 700 block of Belmont Avenue. Johnson and Clay were outside of the residence that was open to the public. Johnson and Clay were both reportedly seen to be highly intoxicated on alcohol by having a strong odor of alcoholic beverages, slurred speech, and red glassy eyes. Johnson and Clay admitted to consuming alcohol and stated they were involved in a disturbance that led to a fight with a deadly weapon. Johnson and Clay both told officers that they were arguing due to Johnson accusing Clay of stealing money that she made overnight at a game room. Johnson and Clay admitted they were in a fight and blamed each other of pulling a knife out and attempting to stab each other. Clay reported that Johnson had attempted to stab her and that she was able to take the knife away from her. Clay had fresh, visible injuries on her left arm and hand that were consistent with her allegation and possibly of being cut with a knife. Johnson reportedly had inconsistent stories on who had the knife and claimed that Clay had the knife and caused bodily injury to her. Officers saw that Johnson had fresh, visible injuries to her left hand, consistent with being cut with a knife. Officers located the knife inside the residence with consent of Johnson. When inside the residence in Johnson's room, officers saw a usable amount of marijuana in plain view. Johnson admitted to the marijuana being hers. Johnson and Clay reportedly had inconsistent stories on who the predominant aggressor was, and each had visible injuries that were consistent with being assaulted with a knife. Johnson and Clay were intoxicated to the degree of being a danger to themselves or others. Johnson and Clay were each arrested, charged, and transported to the Ector County Law Enforcement Center. Johnson has two bonds totaling $30,500 and was still in custody as of Friday afternoon. Clay has two bonds totaling $30,312 and was still in custody as of Friday afternoon. Woman found guilty for death of stepdad. The 28-year-old woman who reportedly admitted to shooting and killing her stepdad on Christmas Day in 2019 was found guilty of murder by an Ector County jury. Jaylene Green was sentenced to 30 years in prison. A Facebook post from Ector County District Attorney Dusty Gallivan detailed, Green also has a fine of $8,000. Kevin Schultz and Scott Turner reportedly presented the case for the state, and Judge Justin Lowe of the 161st District Court presided. According to court records, Scott Lay was Green's court-appointed attorney. The reported fatal shooting happened at 5:38 p.m., December 25, 2019, in the area of 16164 West University Boulevard. ECSO deputies responded to a gunshot victim, and when they arrived, they reportedly found a man, identified as 54-year-old Rick Britton, dead on the ground outside near his residence. He had been shot in the head. Green was found at the scene. She reportedly made the call to 911 and stated she shot her stepdad. During an interview, Green stated she and Britton had lived together for 2 years at the residence, located in the area of 16164 West University Boulevard. She stated she and Britton had gotten into an argument earlier in the day and she couldn't take it anymore. Green reportedly stated it was either her or him, and she made the decision for it to be Britton. Death notices from the Odessa American for Saturday. Stephanie Lynn Shockey, 38, of Gilbert, Arizona, died Saturday, October 16th, in Gilbert. Funeral service will be held at 12 p.m., October 24th, at Gilbert Memorial Park in Gilbert, Arizona. Arrangements are by Gilbert Memorial Park of Gilbert. Linnell Sauer, 68, of Stanton, died Thursday, October 21st, in Stanton. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m., October 26th. At Hosanna Christian Fellowship in Stanton. Burial will follow at Evergreen Cemetery in Stanton. The family will receive guests from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Monday, October 25th at Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home in Midland. Ross Lynn Walker, 57, died Friday, October 15th in Lubbock. Services are pending with American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.